From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Golhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The U.S. House of Representatives on Wednesday voted to end American support for Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen in a rebuke to President Donald Trump. The vote was 248-177, with 18 Republicans siding with Democrats. The Senate had passed a similar measure last year, 56-41, but the previous Republican leadership in the House had refused to hold a vote. Now, with Democrats in power in the House, the bill does move forward. The Senate may pass its version of the bill in the coming weeks. House Republicans did push through an amendment that the U.S. would continue its intelligence-sharing partnership with Saudi Arabia whenever, quote, appropriate in the national security interest of the United States. If the bill does pass the Senate, it isn't clear if President Trump will sign it. My guest is Rahul Mahajan. He's the author of two books on the Iraq War, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, and The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He also teaches at University of Wisconsin, River Falls, and is our foreign policy and empire correspondent. Welcome back, Rahul.
Great to be with you again, Sonali.
So is this a victory for progressives? Many are hailing it. Many progressive organizations are saying this is a really big deal.
It's a partial and primarily symbolic victory. Invocation of the War Powers Act has been very rare since its passage in 1973, so it's great to see Congress reasserting itself in that regard. It's great.
So it was on the basis of that act that Congress did this?
That's correct, and it makes frequent reference to the War Powers Act in the text of the resolution. So it's also great to see the House registering that the war on Yemen is an atrocity and is something that the United States should not continue to support. That said, I think there are two big back doors in the resolution. One, as you said, is the fact that it essentially allows the president to go on authorizing whatever information sharing. And remember, information sharing here doesn't simply mean CIA type stuff about who to target and so on. It also means operational intelligence in terms of ongoing military operations. So it's something that that involves, for example, real-time targeting decisions, et cetera. And second is the loophole for any actions that are directed against AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, as opposed to the Houthis. I mean, it seems to suggest that, in fact, any operations against the Houthis are something that the United States should not support, which is an interesting statement and a step forward. But since it's very easy to justify anything you do in Yemen under the banner of opposing AQAP, it's again not clear how much that actually restricts.
This particular House vote with 18 Republicans, most of them, I believe, from the so-called Freedom Caucus, joining in with Democrats, do you see it as a direct rebuke to Trump, who has, of course, been so overtly eager to cozy up to Saudi Arabia and just basically saying everything's okay because Saudi Arabia buys so many American weapons?
Yes. I mean, look, a lot of progressive Democrats have been against the war in Yemen for some time. People like Ro Khanna, new House member, have been, not that new anymore, I guess, have been very vocal and active about it. But I do not expect that it would have gotten unanimous Democratic support without the murder of Jamal Khashoggi and Trump's sort of very overt support through indifference or through dismissal of that murder.
So the Senate, I'd mentioned, did pass a similar bill last year. Do you expect it to be able to pass this year as well, given that with the House and the Senate together passing these bills would be a pretty strong challenge to Trump?
You know, it's a little early to speculate about the whip count, but I think it'll be very close, because now that it seems like there are more consequences, you know, a Republican senator could register a disapproval of the war on Yemen while resting content in the knowledge that Paul Ryan wouldn't allow it to come to the floor in the House. Now there are more stakes, so some of the Republicans may actually backtrack. I think it'll be a very close vote for sure.
Right. I mean, so essentially the Democrats are calling their bluff. This is the sort of political theater that the two chambers of Congress often engage in. But when push comes to shove, it really remains to be seen how sincere they are about this war. Do you think that, Trump would be sort of challenged into signing it if it were to pass? Because he has attempted to, you know, remain really close to Saudi Arabia. And the feeling now has been, and I think this might even have been Saudi Arabia's strategy, just wait out the controversy over Khashoggi. Eventually, U.S.-Saudi relations could go back to being normal. But we just got news a few days ago that the New York Times, I believe, intercepted information showing that Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, had talked about putting a bullet in Khashoggi last year before he was killed. The story doesn't seem like it's going to go away.
No, I don't think the story is going to go away. Nonetheless, if there wasn't enough else going on, the status quo ante could be restored, although you have to be careful in thinking about what is the status quo ante with regard to U.S.-Saudi relations. To me, there was a fundamental inflection point back in 2011 when the Obama administration allowed without seemingly having much choice, allowed the Saudi military to go into Bahrain and crush the nonviolent Shia uprising there. So I think since then, and this predates MBS's rise to power, since then, Saudi Arabia has made it clear that it is not going to subordinate its own interests as a regional power to the U.S.'s as a global hegemon, and it's also not going to necessarily go along with the United States just for the sake of going along. So I think that status quo ante could be restored, but the old style where this, except occasionally for a little bit about oil prices, the Saudis basically did the bidding of the United States, that's not coming back.
Now, could the timing of this House vote have any bearing on the very tenuous ceasefire in Yemen and pressures the Saudis and the Emiratis, because this is a joint effort from the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia supported by the U.S., could it pressure those two countries to preserve the ceasefire?
I mean, if there was a real complete cessation of any kind of U.S. help and of U.S. diplomatic interference, that would certainly have an effect, like you suggest. But it's not at all clear, whatever the status of a resolution, even if it gets passed in the Senate, that it will affect what Trump actually decides to do. Hmm.
That amendment that the Republicans pushed through about intelligence sharing in where U.S. national security interests are at stake, I'm wondering if that is basically going to be the loophole that can be invoked because it's vague to justify anything.
Yeah, it can be, and Trump is not shy about making presidential determinations mm-hmm. without consulting any of what the rest of us call facts.
Right, and he can declare anything a national security issue, including and justify it using that excuse, including tariffs on other countries. And I'm wondering what impact you think this Yemen vote could have on presidential aspirations. I know that it's, you know, we sort of roll our eyes about the lengthy presidential campaign season we are embarking on. But with Trump in power, it's a nice problem to have, I feel. Could senators vying for a presidential nomination, especially among Democrats, see the Yemen war resolution as a good opportunity to showcase their progressive credentials? Because progressives seem to be having the political upper hand these days.
Well, it's not so much an opportunity as something in which they have to measure up. I think it's stunning. So this is not particularly difficult or controversial one. I mean, yes, the Houthis in Yemen are sort of explicitly anti-American, but it is strictly in the context of propaganda within Yemen. They have never, ever talked about anything that is a national security threat to the United States. This is not very controversial. Look at how presidential hopefuls are dealing with the much more controversial issue of whether we should throw the First Amendment out when it comes to Israel. And there they are getting on the right side because they don't want this to ding them in the presidential race.
Right. Well, speaking of Israel and the controversy around Ilhan Omar, the representative from Minnesota's comments on APAC, which we had actually covered on our show, but Ilhan Omar, thankfully, seems to not have been cowed by the bipartisan uproar over what she said to a Republican representative. And I'm wondering if you saw the very interesting exchange, sort of moving continents to Latin America. I'm wondering if you saw the exchange between Ilhan Omar and U.S. Special Representative to Venezuela in a committee hearing this week, where she took Elliot Abrams to task over the kind of foreign interventionism that he oversaw. She seems to not have let the Israeli, the pro-Israel backlash cow her.
Yeah, I think it was brilliant. I mean, I think she needs to think more about how to figure out how to deal with the sort of snark fest that Twitter is, and her position as a congressperson who is going to be held accountable to Nancy Pelosi and so-called public opinion, and she still has a ways to go on that. But I think it's great to see that she's actually saying, when somebody comes to testify in front of Congress, well, it seems like you're a liar. Why exactly do we want your testimony at all? You also seem to have not just be a liar, but to lie about mass murder.
He got super defensive. Given that you have this Democratic leadership on the issue of Yemen, are you seeing that same kind of leadership on Venezuela? And actually, what is your opinion on the situation in Venezuela? You and I usually talk about U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. The situation in Venezuela is rearing its head. And you tend to see some double standards, with even some liberal politicians feeling like it's perfectly okay for the U.S. to overtly push for regime change in Venezuela?
Well, I'll tell you the truth, and it's not going to make me popular. Of course, I'm opposed to any U.S. push for regime change in Venezuela. The United States is a historical bad actor and is the last country that should be involved in any kind of political pressure in Venezuela, despite the fact that we're in the same hemisphere and the Monroe Doctrine and the rest of it. The United States should butt out. That said, Maduro is not a legitimate ruler at this point. Yes, he was elected in an extremely questionable election, but he also, imagine if Donald Trump, after being elected president, decided to dismiss Congress and set up his own alternative Congress. That is exactly what Maduro did. He is not a democratically legitimate leader, and it is a very complex situation. Juan Guaido is also not a democratically legitimate leader. Something needs to happen to resolve it. The Venezuelan people, whatever their opinion is, and it is obviously very split and very mixed, lack the ability on their own to force some kind of decision, like a new fair election in which everybody gets to run. And so the question of the role of other countries of the so-called international community is complicated. I don't have an answer for you. I think it is reasonable to say that there should be elections. If you are a European colonial, formerly colonialist power, again, you're not really the right person to be saying this. The UN and the UN General Assembly ought to be the place where this kind of thing is discussed. But there is definitely a role for international pressure on Venezuela Venezuela, which has been absolutely run into the ground by an increasingly dictatorial, violent, and bloody ruler.
Shouldn't it be more than just Ilhan Omar attempting to hold Elliot Abrams accountable? I mean, Elliot Abrams, maybe people don't remember because his tenure goes back to the Reagan era. He did get quite defensive during the time when Omar tried to hold him accountable. But it doesn't seem as though his position in the Trump administration is receiving enough pushback from other politicians.
Look, he ideologically he built his reputation on being a neoconservative, part of the early Reagan administration's push for supposedly democratization of various countries. But in fact, he's an accessory to genocide, among other things. He actually supported the resumption of U.S. military aid to Guatemala under Efrem Rios Montt, who has been convicted of genocide against the Maya Ixil Indians in Guatemala. It was well known at the time what Rios Montt was doing. He killed maybe 200,000 people. And the United States actually, because of Congress, was not directly sending them military aid, usually channeling it through countries like Israel. But Abrams was in favor of direct support. I mean, that says all you need to know about the man, I think.
So at this point, do you feel that U.S. foreign policy under Trump is taking a different direction? This is a question you and I have come back to several times, is how to make sense of Trump's foreign policy, both in the Middle East, in a broader sense, these days toward Latin America. Are we seeing a continued path from the unfettering of the military generals, or is he, and you know, with the recent decision to pull back troops out of Syria, the declaration that he was going to end the war in Afghanistan, how to make sense of this man's foreign policy?
Well, I mean, in a word, it's childish. For you know, we saw a little bit of this during the Bush administration, but other than that, this is the first time in the post-war era that we've seen outright childish foreign policy. If you want two words, I'd add sclerotic to that. With regard to Syria, it's pretty clear what happened. So Trump has really stuck himself out there on supporting MBS to the point where even he realized that nobody in the rest of the world was going to go along with it. And so on a phone call with Erdogan, who he's suddenly trying to placate, even though he was attacking him verbally over the summer and exulting in glee at the difficulties of the Turkish economy, now he's trying to placate him. So he suddenly says, oh, we're going to withdraw from Syria, without even knowing what is involved in doing it. With regard to Venezuela, they're talking, childish nonsense that John Bolton probably knows better, but he's encouraging Trump to think about things like, oh, maybe we can get Venezuela's oil if we have regime change. Now, in the past, you know, this is not the kind of direct motivation you'd attribute to any kind of serious policymaker. I mean, and in any case, Iraq should have showed you it's not that easy. I mean, Trump laments the fact that the United States didn't get Iraq's oil. Not exactly clear what he thinks that means, like carrying it out with a scoop or something, but it's not that easy. And it's not going to happen in Venezuela. If anything, if it does ever happen in Venezuela, which is not likely, it's going to be Russia that takes it because of this very bizarre loan that Rosneft made to the Petróleos de Venezuela. But it's certainly not going to be the United States. But still, this kind of extremely childish and ignorant notion may be part of what's driving Trump's obvious mania for some kind of regime change in Venezuela. So it's all over the place. He still gets a lot of political currency when he seems to not be a traditional liberal interventionist and instead to talk like an isolationist America firster. So that's going to continue, but it's going to continue to be an incoherent mess. And actually, in a way, you know, Obama's foreign policy was less coherent than anything we had seen pre-Bush as well. So there is a collapse in general in terms of what exactly U.S. foreign policy is built around, and it goes in part to the fact that it really damaged its claim to hegemony with the Bush administration's adventures.
Hmm. And we didn't even get to talk about Trump's positions on Iran and on North Korea, which are the other two sort of major foreign policy flashpoints, completely opposite approaches to those countries, both based around the nuclear ambitions of these countries. You know, he's essentially now pushing pushing Iran even further in backing it into a corner, and meanwhile hoping to make some peace with North Korea in a summit in Vietnam that's coming up. Again, it seems as though these are probably the whims of a childish leader, right?
I mean, in North Korea, Trump's policy has contradicted itself, right? He started by, again, very childishly goading Kim Jong-un and calling him Little Rocket Man. And you know, at the time, he had advisors like McMaster who were pushing for some kind of military attack on North Korea, and he was going with the flow. And this led to North Korea's getting increasingly aggressive in its own sort of symbolic military statements. And suddenly now there's an about face, and it's a love affair, it's a bromance, and he's going to shut his eyes and pretend that North Korea has made some concessions or is going to. And at least with North Korea, there's only so far he can screw things up, because North Korea has nuclear weapons. They're not going away no matter what the United States does. And the best thing is maybe to just ignore it, and we can all pretend that we don't know the other exists. With Iran, though, he is really he's really screwing things up, because they had a deal which would keep Iran from getting nuclear weapons, and now he has opened the door to their having them. Now, it's not clear that means they will try to get them. Ayatollah Khamenei has said clearly that even the acquisition of nuclear weapons is an immoral act. But of course, he probably won't live forever. And we don't know what will happen after that. So there he's just opening the door that had been very, very carefully and painstakingly sealed shut by the Obama administration.
Well, Rahul, always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Great to be with you.
Rahul Mahajan is the author of two books on the Iraq War, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, and The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He also teaches at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls, and is the U.S. Foreign Policy and Empire Correspondent for our program. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.